Hello, everybody. I am Jake Mintz.
And I'm Jordan Schusterman. On this Thursday special edition of Baseball Barbacast, we have a special guest. It's Mike Zunino, the recently retired big league catcher who we have been calling good for a long time. He was kind enough to join us. Special interview there. And before then, we're going to talk about a massive trade. Dylan Cease is going to the Padres. We got a lot to get to on this Thursday, Jake.
Mike Zunino has 149 career home runs, and we have the same amount as Dylan Cease. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that will never cease being good. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And we have a show and a half for you today.
You know, in these lead ups to the season, we're doing division previews and it's like, what's going to happen that is going to throw us off schedule? Sometimes for the best possible reason. On this special bonus Thursday edition, we are, of course, going to be talking about the Padres' massive decision to trade prospects, including some they just got, for Dylan Cease. But the second half of the show is even more special to us in particular because we will be interviewing the recently retired Mike Zunino. But before we get to Mike, let's get into this trade, Jake. This is how it always works, right? Of course, we do the NL West preview yesterday, and I'm glad I snuck in that one line saying, hey, you know, the Padres might still be in on Cease. Well, last night, we finally get the news, the Jeff Passan all caps breaking we've all been waiting for. Dylan Cease has finally been traded, and he is going to the San Diego Padres.
Who could have seen it coming? Only everybody for months.
So I actually want to start with, listen, I think we all knew Cease was going to get traded. Okay, sure, they could have held on to him until the deadline, but no, that was not going to be a smart thing to do, right? How many pitchers do you need to see go down that you weren't expecting to go down? Sure, Dylan Cease hasn't missed a start in 4 or 5 years. They knew they had to trade him before opening day, and that became right. Very clear over the last week. So the White Sox trading Dylan Cease, not at all surprising.
Well, I want to talk about the Pedro Grifol Grifol quote. Mm-hmm. So the manager of the White Sox, Pedro Grifol, was asked whether he thought Dylan Cease was going to be the opening day starter, and he responded, quote, I don't know. I mean, how am I supposed to know that? I don't know what's going to happen out there. The idea that Grifol's like, how am I supposed to know? My guy, we're not asking you about like international geopolitics, right, or, you know, engineering a bridge, yeah, like you, or like the Royals. Like, we are asking you about the baseball team that you manage.
Yeah.
It's whether like, your best pitcher will still be there in a week. It feels like something you should know about.
It's like one of the most basic questions. If you're power ranking questions you ask managers during spring training, who's starting on opening day is pretty high on the list, especially in the middle of March. We're not that far away from opening day.
Right. But that non-answer kind of spoke volumes that a trade was getting more and more likely, and Cease will be on his way to the San Diego Padres. Jordan, let's do this. Read out the trade in full. We'll talk about the prospects going back to the White Sox in this deal. Talk about their angle. And then we'll hop into the Padres side of things and how this fits into the Soto trade and the financial element.
Sure. So Dylan Cease, who has 2 years remaining on his contract, I believe he is set to make around $8 million this year. Which is relevant to the larger Padres conversation, I'm sure, is going to the San Diego Padres for four players. That includes three prospects, and that's certainly who we'll focus on here. Two pitching prospects, the first of which they just got in the Juan Soto trade from the New York Yankees. That is Drew Thorpe, who was one of the best pitchers in minor league baseball last year and looked fantastic this spring. By the way, the Drew Thorpe Padres spring training jersey, if you can get a hand on one of those, that thing's going to go hard. All right. And it's, I'm just saying, if that is a piece of merch I would love to have if someone could find one for me.
A Coachella must.
Yes, exactly. So Drew Thorpe is the first, certainly, I think, the most high profile name, especially since he's already been. I mean, how many prospects have been in two massive blockbusters in the same offseason? That feels like a special achievement. The two other prospects, Jairo Iriarte. This is someone who really burst last year, a pitcher who, you know, again, the Padres have done a tremendous job in all avenues of talent acquisition on the amateur side. And he was someone that was not necessarily a big deal when he signed originally out of Venezuela, but the last couple seasons, it has really popped. And while he is not, he's a slender lad, but my goodness, does he throw hard. One of the most electric, you know, arsenals in all of minor league baseball last year, nearly 13 Ks per nine. And to the point where at the end of last season, when they were talking about bringing him up at the end of last season, which I know sounds ridiculous because the Padres were actually technically still in the mix at the end of last year. And as we know, the Padres have no problem rushing their prospects. So he, as a 21-year-old last year, was already considered possibly big league ready, at least as a reliever. Now we can assume the White Sox will continue to develop as a starter.
And then who's the last guy?
And then Samuel Zavala, an outfielder who is still only 19 until July. He's someone who at this time last year, coming off a season where he reached A-ball as a 17-year-old, had a ton of buzz. Last season, he reaches high A as an 18-year-old. It's a very advanced approach. Walked 94 times as an 18-year-old, mostly all in A-ball. So that alone is very impressive. The question with him is he a center fielder? How much power is there really? He's also kind of a small guy. But it's a long road to get there. You got to develop a talent like this. It's not just going to happen. He's like in that sweet spot of there's a lot of reason to be excited, but you don't exactly know what you're getting. But that is a big upside swing. That is a lottery ticket if you've ever seen one, and someone who already reached high A as an 18-year-old. So again, those are reasons to be excited. And then Stephen Wilson. Poor Stephen Wilson, who was probably all packed for Korea, is now having to pack for Camelback Ranch.
Let's touch on Stephen Wilson very briefly.
Yeah.
Career grinder, reliever, played winter ball. And the worst part of this deal for him, in my opinion, if you go to Korea, like if you make that roster, MLB pays players for the schlep, right? Because in order to incentivize like the union and the PA to agree to do these games, players are paid. They're compensated for that. And the number we heard is like, it is like tens of thousands of dollars to go over to Korea and play these games. Stephen Wilson.
Yeah.
Like that's a guy who could have used 50 grand. Yeah,
that's true. However, here's what I'm going to push back on that. Stephen Wilson is now in a great position to be the closer of the Chicago White Sox, which if he can rack up even like 15 big league saves, he's making up that money in arbitration in a couple of years.
Now, it's true.
It'd be nice to just have the money, in a couple of weeks when you get back from Seoul. And I imagine this is certainly a big vibe shift here. But he'll be okay. He'll be okay. See, Stephen Wilson, again, an Uli Dome legend as well. I'm sure he's going to enjoy the higher leverage. He has one career save, I guess, but those leverage innings, even for a bad team, are definitely going up.
So the question whenever a deal like this happens is how they do, right? And it is both a good question and a dumb question because we really will not know how they do for a number of years. But what we can do is compare this haul to other trades for similar players that have happened recently. And the obvious one here is Corbin Burnes, right? The Orioles acquiring Corbin Burnes, 1 year of Corbin Burnes in exchange for DL Hall, a left-handed hard-throwing pitcher who's probably a reliever, maybe a starter, and Joey Ortiz, who looks like an everyday infielder. Jordan, a very simple question is, would you rather have the haul the Padres gave up or the haul the Brewers gave up?
I think...
Or the Orioles gave up.
Yeah, yeah. Again, and it's different circumstances, of course, because not just the... 1 year versus 2 years, but what these teams were trying to accomplish, right? The Brewers were not going to trade for an 18-year-old outfielder if they were going to trade Corbin Burnes, right? That was not going to happen. So these teams had very different goals here. And so I think I lean slightly towards towards Chicago's side. I just think that Iriarte, to me, is the key to this even more than Zavala, because Thorpe is a pretty safe. Again, we don't know exactly what the ceiling is, but like he's going to throw a lot of big league innings this year, and you kind of know what you're getting. Iriarte could range in a lot of different directions in an exciting way, in a concerning way. And again, this is the other thing, as I'm thinking about the context. I mean, I trust the Brewers to get the most out of DL Hall more than the White Sox to get the most out of anybody, right? And so that leaves me stuck with thinking, I'm already thinking about these players in different ways. But for White Sox fans, I will say, I think they did quite well here. I really do.
I think they did solidly. I think there is like there is a lack of obvious upside here, especially when you compare it to the other prospects the Padres could have given up. And in talking to people who've seen that system quite a bit, there's a preference for Robbie Snelling and Dylan Lesko. Now, were the Padres willing to give those guys up? That's a different conversation.
Clearly, no. Would guess they asked about Dylan Lesko and Robbie Snelling. Like, I would take that as a something of a definitive answer. And as we've learned with the Padres in general, right? Like, who is untouchable? You know, we always assume certain guys are more untouchable than others. I mean, Jackson Merrill, it's possible he was on the table 2 months ago and it just didn't quite line up, right? And then he comes out, has an awesome spring, and now he's the center fielder. So these things change all the time. But to your point, I think that's fair. Like, yes, there's higher upside prospects in the Padres system. That doesn't make these players not good. It just means the Padres system is ridiculous.
Right. I do think that there is, like, White Sox fans should feel fine.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like,
I want to be clear. Yeah. No, I just want to be clear. I don't think this is like a day of celebration. Yeah, is I guess my point. Because
was the White Sox fan a day of celebration? I mean, honestly, like at this point, we all knew the trade was coming. I mean, sure, I guess they could have landed a top 10 prospect and everyone was like, this is a franchise pillar, but no version of this trade. We're not gonna know. As you said that at the top, right? So I agree.
That's
with
my
you.
Point. Yeah. Is it like yeah. I'm not saying that people are acting this way, okay? But like when you trade away a player like this, that's a bad day, right? That you have that the organization, that the franchise has allowed itself to get into a position where trading away Dylan Cease is seen as a necessity.
Oh,
that's not a good thing. Maybe, yes, like accepting the circumstances where you're currently in and making the most of that is positive. We need to see whether this new White Sox player development apparatus is going to turn these players into good players, into good big leaguers. We haven't seen it yet. It's a new regime full of old Royals.
I was going to say, it's a new regime and it's not, right? I mean, Chris Getz was literally the farm director. So that's the thing. That's where the skepticism comes in. But I understand what you're saying. I think that they did quite well. But I think we have to flip this to the Padres side. And before we get to Dylan Cease, the pitcher, who's on the Padres now, let's get to the other element of, oh my God, like all these tweets over the last day, I can't believe the Padres pulled it off. I can. Like, how many times do we have to watch them do this? And how many times do we have to watch them throw their hands up and say, listen, okay, fine. All you people want to just pass up on this ridiculously talented player? All right, sure. I mean, they've done it, what now, like 10 times over the last three seasons. And because they're so good at acquiring, you know, that younger talent and flipping them at sometimes the right time, at sometimes the wrong time. I mean, you've traded away this many prospects. Some of them are going to come back and make you look pretty stupid. I mean, they certainly have their handful of those. And maybe there will be some of those in this too. But in the grand scheme of things, this was a situation where we knew, we just talked about it yesterday, that they had so many innings to cover going into this year. They lost. And by the way, trading away Steven Wilson, that's another 50 innings out the door. Nearly half of the innings from last year were gone. And what they had done so far was creative, but didn't actually seem like enough. This, even when you're trading Drew Thorpe, who might have helped this year, looks a lot more like, okay, now we've actually sufficiently backfilled what we've lost in a very real way.
Because Dylan Cease posts. That's another thing, right? Pitcher injuries, who knows? It's a crapshoot. It's roulette. But like, this is a guy who starts games and has stayed healthy as well as a pitcher can. You say like this idea that the people are shocked. They can keep getting away with this. They can.
well,
they right, are.
Let's not be surprised that AJ Preller keeps doing it. And by the way, I saw a tweet suggesting that Preller saw Cease pitch yesterday. And this was from someone in San Diego. So I could be wrong that this was just total, you know, BS rumor, but I'm just going to run with it anyway, because I think it's just a funny scenario and not that implausible. But I love the idea that Preller watched Cease last night and watched Yamamoto get blasted by the Mariners and was like, you know what? Screw it. Like, let's do it. Why not? Like, let's not that it's like this move is going to push the Dodgers that much. But like, we talked about it yesterday. Like, there's still too many good players on this team to punt on this season. And while you could say, well, then why did they trade Juan Soto? Clearly, they were operating under a situation where either they were going to hold Juan Soto and do absolutely nothing because that was the financial situation they were working under, or they were going, like a few other teams, like Seattle, like some other teams we've seen this winter. It's like, all right, listen, here's the budget you're working with. do whatever you want, but that's what you're working with. And I want to also mention, you know, the $160 million number you referenced yesterday on Fangraphs, like that is, I guess, like exact salaries for this year. The luxury tax payroll is much closer to the luxury tax line because their AAVs for all of their ridiculous extensions is so much higher than what these guys are actually making this year. So they didn't have as much, or 160 is not as much, you know, 167 is maybe what the players are making this year. It's much closer to the line. I think that's an important number to consider when you think about how much flexibility they actually had in making this move. I think now it puts their luxury payroll up to 224, right? 225. Again, this is, you know, via Fangraphs roster resource, which is incredible, and we could not do our jobs without it. But yeah, so I would just say that that is something to consider too. Like, clearly the Padres had a little bit of room to work with, and they decided that trading Soto was going to be the only way to have a competitive team this year and have enough pitchers. And I think you kind of see that. I wouldn't want to trade Juan Soto, and I'm sure AJ Preller didn't want to, because he's the guy that trades for Juan Soto, right? You could imagine that kind of person, that kind of GM, doesn't want to trade him away. But that's the situation that they work with, and I think it's pretty exciting that they're going for it again.
We'll get back to Preller in a second. Let's just talk about Cease. So what type of pitcher is this? I think I've seen this a bunch online so far in the last 12 hours. The idea that he's a right-handed Blake Snell. Yeah.
I mean, he is. Like,
pretty much.
He's.
He's similarly frustrating in that he works deep counts and throws a lot of pitches and doesn't work excessively deep into games as much as some other more pitch to contact oriented starters. He's a two-pitch guy. I mean, he has a curveball, but it's mostly fastball slider. The slider is the pitch, right? And as is the case often with guys who have awesome sliders, the best version of that includes a lot of sliders outside the strike zone, which often leads to takes, which leads to deep counts, which leads to high pitch counts, right? And so that is kind of like the Snell comparison, even though Snell has, you know, four pitches. You look confused.
No, you're totally right. And that's where the kind of the comparison, I think, falls off a bit, is that, I mean, the reason Cease can get away with essentially two pitches, and it's not as much as like what we've seen from Strider, but I mean, the slider is one of the best pitches in baseball, right? So, I mean, all of Snell's stuff is really good. But Cease's slider is, I mean, by run value, I think it was the best pitch in baseball last year, even amongst a disappointing season, right? Like, he is absurdly talented. and when you compare that with the bulk and making third start, that's something that Snell hasn't had, right? And I would say that the question now is, you know, we saw Snell kind of, it's weird because it's like, okay, he had his best season and he maximized in San Diego, but he also was still walking everybody. So how Cease changes under pitching coach Ruben Niebla, I'm super fascinated by. But Cease the personality, Cease the pitcher, I'm just a huge fan. I'm buying in. Like, that's why I really like this for San Diego. I just think, again, not to mention that they clearly needed it. Like, they needed it as much as almost anybody here. The upside is absolutely still present, and it's 2 years, right? They have 2 years with him too, which is also an exciting opportunity, because I'm sure they were kicking around deals for Burns, you know, and Bieber and some of the other one-year guys, but having him with two also makes this a little bit easier to swallow.
Yeah. Last 3 years for Cease, he was solid in 2021, amazing in 2022, where he kind of outpitched his peripherals. I mean, he had a 2.2 ERA and led the league in walks, if we want to talk about Snell-esque. It's the same thing. Finished second in the Cy Young. And then last year was kind of the opposite. Like, he was almost unlucky. Like, he had a 3.72 FIP and his ERA was 4.58.
Yes.
And his walks were still, you know, just as high, if not higher, on a rate basis. So
the walks and all that stuff I just want to say, what is also different? The defense. I mean, the White Sox defense was about as bad as it could be last year. And the Padres, while they have some weird stuff going on, it should still be an upgrade. Even if Jackson Merrill is a complete catastrophe in center, that's something. But no, this defense is way better.
Way better. Yeah. I mean, Ha-Sung Kim is a Gold Glover. Mm-hmm. And Manny Machado is still very, very good. And Tatis is a banger in right field. Like, that already is better than what the White Sox were able
hopefully
to
Bogarts
provide.
Can play second. I assume
hopefully
he can.
Bogarts can play second.
But we'll see.
So C specifically, I like it. I think he provides dependability with a whole lot of upside. I think he's better than he was last year. I don't think he's as good as he was in 2022. But if you start Dylan Cease in game two of a postseason series, like, you feel good about that, right? I'm totally fine with that. Yep. I don't think he's in the top tier of starters, but you could easily see a scenario where he is better than Blake Snell in 2024. And he has the one thing Snell does not have right now, and that is a baseball team. Quickly talk about AJ Preller and how he fits into this.
Yeah. I mean, this is, I've had this conversation 100 times now about him because he's made so many deals. But at this point, when you have, clearly he was in lockstep with Peter Seidler. And when Seidler passed away, we no matter how, whatever the new ownership was going to kind of be communicating, and I, not that I don't believe that they don't kind of believe in Preller and want to stick with him, at some point, there needs to be a little bit more consistency in terms of the major league success. And we had that taste of it in 2022. Is he firmly on the chopping block? Maybe that's a bit of a stretch, but I still do think that he has acted with aggression. That is not an accident. And he knows that, like, listen, Samuel Zavala, bless his heart. It's cool that we, signed him and watched him flourish into this cool prospect. I need the guy that can help. He's acted like the whole time. He's always done this, right? The Soto deal then why would you trade Soto? That was clearly just the situation that he was in. And so it's not surprising that he went out of his way to still make sure he shows everybody, we are going for it. Our team is good enough. And we'll see if I'm going to be here to see this out, if the ownership wants to stick with me or go in another direction by the end of the season, depending on how it goes. And he had that right, and ownership let him do it. And respect them for being on the same page enough to go for it like this.
But the circumstances have changed for him. Like, Preller was given an abnormal amount of leash, right? Like, a that's been crazy true for a amount long of time. Leash for a long time, relatively.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It was different. He was given more. That is not going to be the case anymore because the ownership situation has shifted.
We assume. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But that's my sense.
Yes. Yeah. But what I'm saying is, you can see a scenario. It's much more like possible that the Padres win 73 games and they can Preller. Like, that is much more realistic now than it was like a year ago.
Yeah.
Right. And so because of that, he's not living for tomorrow. Like, this is it.
Never has been. Yeah.
Never has been. And so Preller is one of the most fascinating characters in baseball for me because he is so clearly elite at an important aspect of being a GM. He can identify talent in the minor league level, and he can convince other teams that his prospects are good, right? Those two things are valuable, and he has shown that to be a repeatable skill. There are some things that AJ Preller is very bad at, in my opinion, and that is like communication and setting like a stable culture in an organization, and player development sometimes, and building depth. Not good at that. However, I think that like in this particular context of this particular trade, it's an example of his skill set working to the team's advantage.
Yeah, and by the way, if Preller is thinking, I am going to be here forever, he can also think, well, guess what? I can replace Zavala, Uriarte, and Thorpe in a year. You know, a year from now, there's going to be some prospect that they took in the eighth round or some, hard-throwing, lefty from Venezuela that's like one of the top prospects of baseball, because that's just what they've done, right? Now, again, it's only translated to a very limited amount of major league success so far. And that's why that's the standard we should be holding them to. But that's the other thing he's thinking is, listen, as much as it hurts to trade these guys, we got another wave coming. And they have another wave that we already know about that's still there. So
yeah,
the Padres eternally fascinating. All right, Jake, before we get to Mike Zunino, quick other bit of news that is pretty significant. By the way, Mike Zunino's on this podcast, so we should.
Cool.
So I'm excited for that. Devin Williams, another less exciting Jeff Passan bit of news last night. Devin Williams, the closer for the Brewers, will be out for a couple months with a back fractures in his back. That sounds horrible. That is kind of injury where I'm like, how is that only 2 months? I don't understand at all.
That is a great point. Like, sometimes we get injuries and it's like, this guy's out for 4 months. Like, what was it when like Mike Trout missed 4 months with like a calf problem? Right. I was like, get back out here. Right. Meanwhile, Devin Williams is like 2 months with a back fracture. You should quit. You should retire.
The ridiculous thing is we had like hints about this when he reported this recently, and Pat Murphy was like, ah, he'll be fine. Like, the scan didn't show anything. And then he got a second opinion. They're like, yeah, you have a stress fracture in your back. So you're going to not pitch for the next couple of months. I mean, this is simple. It's really just, it adds to the intrigue of this Brewers season. Devin Williams, you know, we said, okay, they trade Corbin Burns. They're still going for it. But what does that look like? It's going to be a lot of young guys. Oh, they still have Devin Williams. Are they going to trade him? Are they going to trade Willy Adames? Can they still win without Devin Williams? Yes, but my goodness, has he been so important to their entire operation that while they do have all kinds of randos in the bullpen that will probably be awesome, like Trevor Megill and Joel Piamps. Go check out Joel Piamps' Baseball Savant page. I just want to throw that out there, people. Go take a little gander at that. You know, Abner Ribe also, you know, throws 103. They have guys, but this is a big deal. So I don't know. It's not like they can go sign an all-world closer. And I don't know how this impacts the trade value. That's another part of this too. But it's big news, so we are acknowledging it.
All right. Let's move on.
It's time.
To the moment we and very few other people have been waiting for. And that is our conversation with the one and the only Mike Zunino.
Yes. So Mike Zunino recently announced his retirement. As I think a good amount of you know, he's been one of certainly my favorite players, but collectively someone that has become very important to the BBQ brand, if you'll call it, by accident. But he's also an awesome, awesome dude and someone we've run into down the line. And we've said, oh, we'd love to get you on the podcast. This felt like a fitting time. Had some technical difficulties along the way. So it's not necessarily the best quality interview we've ever done. But we're so glad we were able to make it happen. And we hope that the listeners enjoy it because we enjoyed it. And Mike's a great dude. So hopefully you enjoy this interview with Mike Zunino, who is good, of course. And we'll be back at the end to wrap it up. Enjoy our conversation with Mike Z. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We are now very excited to be joined by a very special guest. Jake, it's as good as it gets. It's Mike Zunino. Mike Zunino, welcome to Baseball Barbacast. This is a long time coming. You just recently announced your retirement. First and foremost, congratulations. How are you feeling? You are a retired Major League Baseball player. How are you feeling?
First, thank you. I feel great. You know, it's one of those things where I can remember the beginning of it all like it was yesterday. So to think, is, 11 seasons and everything that's happened in between, it's been awesome. But the game takes a toll on you sometimes, and it's one of those things where I couldn't ask for it to go any other way. I've been able to experience a lot. So just very grateful and blessed for how it all turned out.
And we're not getting like a Brett Favre, Roger Clemens style thing where like every June it's like, oh, Z's back, like we have a decade of you going to play for the Vikings and whatever.
No, you know what, it was one of those things. Once February rolled around, I got like a little bit of antsiness knowing I should be doing something. When it's part of your life for that long, I can look back to even how the last couple spring trainings were and what I was just trying to do in spring training to make sure the body was ready to go into 162, and I think I maybe got 40 games each one of those two seasons. But it's one of those things where it's just so instilled in you, what you do in the off seasons, what you do in spring trainings. Even my wife was saying, we're usually, hustling around, packing the kids up, packing the cars up. So we're wired in a way where that time, one, it's fun for us. And two, it's a big part of getting to the season. But no, right now it is, I'm happy. The body's feeling great. So it's just going on enjoying following baseball as a fan.
When you're a pro baseball player, the rhythm of your life is the same like every year. And so when you talk about getting ready to go to spring, like your body clock, like your muscle memory is like, all right, time to pack up the car. Is there something that you're looking forward to doing over the summer, whether that's like July 4th or being at someone's birthday in mid-May? Like, are there anything, like any activities that you never got to do because you spent your whole summers playing ball?
Yeah, I would just say so, my wife, myself, and my daughter, our birthdays all are at the end of March. My son's, midway through April. So being around for those birthdays, as you start to grow a family, and you realize, I think opening day has been on my wife's birthday a couple times. Not ideal for that stuff. But like just seeing those things. Yeah, being injured the last couple of years, I was back for a couple of July 4th, and you're just like, man, like this is. I could see why the big deal of it, you know, for everybody else, and it's fun to be playing on those days. You know, the nostalgia of, you know, baseball on the 4th of July is it is hard to beat. But I was, you know, out back with my brother-in-law's last night. It's like 63 degrees, and we were hanging out, and I was just like, my one brother-in-law goes, man, this would be a perfect night for Sunday night baseball. I was like, I don't know what that's like, you know, to be able to sit back, weather's nice, throw on a game and relax. You're either playing in it or you're traveling, you know, so I'm just looking forward to doing that and you know, taking a step back and watching baseball as a fan, because the last couple of years, you know, there's been some positive changes in the game, but you know, it's a whirlwind. Once that season starts, there's no stopping it.
Jordan, I know exactly what you were about to say, which is the Rays and Mariners were not often put on Sunday night baseball.
Well, that's definitely true. But that actually was not what I was going to say. I was just going to say, as you were describing, you know, that scene and, you know, Jake's kind of looking ahead to the summer, but even right now, right? Like as a catcher, and we're going to get into life as a catcher and what makes being a catcher so difficult in the major leagues. And I think you're obviously qualified to talk about that, but catchers are so busy in spring training in particular. I mean, you're not only are you having to meet like 100 new people and learn all these different pitchers, but you're the one catching the bullpen. You're the one hauling your bags all over the place. I watched you do this a year ago in Cleveland spring training, you know, like this, it's nice to probably just hang out and be like, oh man, I don't have to do all my catcherly duties anymore.
Yeah. You know, it's something I thoroughly enjoy. I think, you know, the thing that you miss the most, and, you know, I can talking to people that have retired, that have walked away from the game on their terms, you know, what you miss is you miss the camaraderie, you miss the clubhouse feel. And, you know, you could be 32, 33, you could be 45, you know, you're still going to miss it when you walk away. But I think it's unique for, you know, obviously my position, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you go in and it's like, you're not only meeting, you know, maybe the 15 potential pitchers on the team, you're meeting 25 of them. And you want that relationship to be there. It's a part I thoroughly enjoyed about it, working with the pitching side of it, working with pitching coaches, working with bullpen coaches. You know, I've been very fortunate, you know, my 4 years in Tampa taught me a lot. And then it was awesome going back to Cleveland last year, being able to rekindle, you know, with Carl Willis and be able to catch up with a guy that was my original pitching coach when I first got called up. But seeing how the game's changed, you know, every year was a new learning experience. Technology's advanced it. Scouting reports have advanced it. It's just sort of turned everything, you know, in a different direction, which I don't think is bad, but it's more in depth.
So just one last thing. You talk about what you'll miss. So I played like mediocre Division III baseball, right? And when I walk by a field and there are people playing, I feel no itch. But if I'm on a charter bus on the way to like a wedding, oh my God, do I miss ball, right? Like that, those are the moments that you miss. It's less about like the playing of the sport, and obviously you miss that too, but it's like all the ancillary stuff around it, right? Like the feeling of being on a bus and it's like, you look around and everyone's in a suit. And you're like, what? Like what are we doing here? Like someone put on a movie.
Yeah. I think, you know, you're going to go through all those levels, you know, we haven't flown anywhere yet, but I'm sure the first time you hop on a plane, you're like, man, you know, X amount of time I was spent on the plane traveling around the country just to go do, you know, what I've loved. You know, so those little things that, you know, you're not used to. But yeah, like so far, you know, I've been able to, you know, stay busy. You know, my son is into baseball. I'm very lucky with that. So it's one of those things I can just, you know, I'm living it through him. Any itch I have to go do it, I can go throw on BP or play catch with him. But, you know, it's been nice. I mean, I think the biggest thing is, you know, over the last couple of years is getting my body back to a point where I'll be able to continue to do that. And, you know, that's the wear and tear of the job. It's what we, the reason why we were able to do it for so long, but at the same time to be able to, you know, move on in advance and be able to have your health too.
So we want to do definitely some reflecting on your major league career, but I want to go back, you know, a lot farther than that. This is a question we like to ask a lot of big leaguers at any stages of their career, because at some point you kind of realize like, oh, I'm a little bit better than my friends. And so I'm curious for you, I know growing up in a baseball family as well, when did you kind of realize, how old were you when you're like, all right, like baseball is going to be my thing. I might be a little bit better than everyone else around.
Yeah. You know, I played up until my freshman year of high school, I was like, we had a catcher that played D1, went to FGCU. So I played shortstop that year. I wasn't a big guy, you know, even going into Florida, you know. You know, and then I went in, I had some really good years in high school. Thought I knew the window where I was going to get drafted at. And that passed, you know, ended up going to the 30th round, wasn't offered a dime by Oakland. And then, you know, went to Florida and it almost brought me back to reality because the area I played in, you know, we faced a guy maybe throwing mid to upper 80s and it was a good starter. And then I got to UF and I mean, we got guys from Miami and Tampa and Orlando throwing 95. And I was like, this knocked me back down to reality. But what it did, that point challenged me. I battled some injuries my freshman year. And towards the end, I started having some really good at bats. Going into my sophomore year, stuff started piecing together. And I think that's when the confidence really took off for me. I sort of knew who I was as a catcher, as a player. And, you know, it was probably a little bit later when I for sure thought that it could be something I really could do.
So I think that's a good transition, actually, as we move into your major league career, because something that, of course, as you know, and you know, Mariners fans like myself know, like your development and story was expedited, right? Like that was a big part of it. It went faster than most players, especially when we talk about for a catcher and all the things that go along with that. And so you just mentioned that experience of, you know, showing up to UF and being like, oh, my God, this is a little bit different than high school baseball. I imagine there was some level of that when you get to the major leagues in a year, you know, and that adjustment, let alone the responsibilities behind the plate. So what was that like? Because for most people, it's not like we're going to talk to a baseball player that says, man, I wish I spent more time in the minors. But in your case, I'm curious what that experience was like for that to all happen that quickly and then to really find your footing at the big league level over the stretch of a few years.
Yeah, I would say, like, reflecting on that, you know, my biggest thing was more stubborn and knowing my ability and just trusting what I was doing early on. I was confident of how I could manage a pitching staff. I felt pretty good with that. You know, but I feel like getting rushed up there, you know, sometimes people always want to either put a stamp on you or do that. But I mean, I remember clear as day, and I don't know if I ever told Raul this story, Raul Ibanez, but I mean, I would walk down in there and it's like Raul Ibanez, Jason Bay, like all these guys are watching film, you know, in the film room of their swing. And I was just like, you know, I had an approach in college. I was stubborn with it. I knew what I was going to do. It may not have been the prettiest swing, but I would go up there and compete. But I'm watching these guys I grew up watching in the playoffs, watching on these great teams. And I'm like, well, they're watching their, you know, how are they breaking down their swing? And I sort of floated that way. And I put too much thought into it instead of just trusting my ability. It wasn't their fault. It was me being green and not knowing what 162 looked like, not really ever having a film room to break film down. I mean, it was before all this data was out there. And, you know, going back there, it was overwhelming in that sense. You know, I had a great guy and I always tell, but Kyle Seager was the guy that took me under his wing. And, you want to talk about a guy that watches too much film. It was him, but, you know, but he helped me with that. He helped me find the balance. But as a young kid that always was able to work hard, you know, I think sometimes I put myself behind the eight ball doing too much. And then, you know, almost driving myself into the ground a little bit as, you know, before games, putting work in.
If you think Kyle Seager watches a lot of film, oh, his little brother is like a whole other hemisphere of watching film.
Yeah, I went up there to North Carolina in like 2015, 2016. And the guy he was hitting with, Kyle was like, fly up, you know, like, he'll take a look at your swing, like, stay with me. So my wife and I drove up and we went up there. And he comes up and Kyle and I were hitting like Thursday through a Sunday. And Kyle and I are going, working on stuff. They're telling us drills to do. And it's taking us a few rounds to get it. And he tells Corey to do like one thing. And Corey all of a sudden comes up and, you know, does it in the first three swings. Then he goes out of town for 2 days and comes back on Sunday or Saturday and does exactly what he was doing 2 days ago. And I'm like, I mean, some guys, like Kyle would say, some guys just got it. Like he was able to pick up those cues, apply it right away, you know, and that's why he's the player he is, you know. He's very attentive, but he can apply those changes and make them, you know, natural rather quickly.
Yeah, it's like, it's one thing to understand a concept, but it's another to have almost like the athletic intelligence to immediately put it into action. And that is a split, like, in the big leagues, right? There are some guys who are athletic and they can do the move, but they don't know why they can do the move. And having talked to people about like Corey Seager, he is the guy who very much understands how and why the inner machinations of his specific move. I want to hop back to what you were talking about before. When you got to the big leagues, the sense I get is that the offensive side of the game for you was more of a challenge than the defensive side. Was there any, like when you got there, did you feel ready to go as a catcher?
Yeah, I felt like, you know, that was something I could always put in. And like I said, the game was different then in terms of how the catching position even got evaluated. You know, it was receiving, you know, was there, but it wasn't quantified until a couple years later. You know, calling a game was still, you know, you could go about that as more of an old school way. And then seeing what it's transitioning to now, and every club's different. You know, I learned a lot, you know, going back with Carl in Cleveland than what we were doing in Tampa. So you can see where stuff changes. But when I got up there, I felt pretty confident that. And honestly, when I first got called up, I should go back and say it, like that 2013 season, it was actually good. You know, like I was hitting well, and then I broke my hamate bone in July, and I think I came back in like 22 days. It was like young, you know, green, like, hey, like I want to show these guys I'm tough. I want to be the catcher of the future. And like I look back and I'm like, man, like I think we were like 15 games out of first place, 16 games out. And I was like, man, if I would have just taken my time, because little do I know, you know, that injury happening late in the season and rushing back hurts, you know, your overall, you know, whether it's your strength going into the offseason or how you're going to feel hitting, like all these little things that you change, you know, were creatures of manipulation just to be able to get through a game or get through an at bat. And, you know, now looking back, you know, as a 22-year-old kid, you know, I was doing what I thought was right. I can't blame that. But when I tell guys now and I'm like, look, if it takes you an extra week, an extra 10 days, you know, 2 weeks, just do that. You know, like we will patch gap it. We will be fine. But, you know, that's something that could affect something way further down the road.
So you mentioned that battle early on, especially when you are kind of rushed to the big leagues that quickly and you are, you know, the high draft pick. Oh, I got to be the catcher of the future. It takes a few years. You have the injuries, but then it really starts to, you know, come together in 2016, 2017. A lot is made of that trip to Tacoma. This is something that I remember, of course, remember very vividly. This is really when, you know, I'm tweeting Mike Zunino is good, you know, three times a week. This is really when it's picking up. Okay. I'm curious, as you reflect on that time, was there one moment, was there one hitting meeting, was there one adjustment that you kind of unlocked something offensively where it was like, okay, I'm starting to figure something out? Because, of course, you know, in 2014, it's not like you weren't hitting home runs, but it really started to come together a little bit more completely offensively at that point.
Yeah, that was a lot of factors that went into that. And I think there was a lot of built up, you know, tension. You know, I had, you know, different hitting coach. I mean, I had four or five different hitting coaches, you know, so I got to a place where it was like, I was with the organization I was drafted by. And I was just looking for, you know, some type of stability in terms of what I was going to do in making swing adjustments, instead of just trying to swing. Well, I found something in the cage. Well, I got sent down and, I ended up working with Mike Micucci, who was the field coordinator at the time, and he was in charge of catchers in spring training. And it was a guy that I really trusted. And he sort of broke it down in an interesting standpoint. He was like, look, he's like, I'm not saying you run at the same rate. I'm not saying you do certain things at the same rate. He's like, but let's look at your athleticism in the batter's box and let's compare it to somebody. But your athleticism and your strength. And the first person he pulled out was like Mike Trout. And I started laughing. And I was like, get out of here. Like, he's like, no, he's like, I'm being serious. Like, if we're going into the batter's box and we're just asking you to do a task, he's like, I'm not asking you what you're going to do once you leave the batter's box. He's like, I'm just saying, like, in that batter's box, what do you like, who can we compare you to? And I was like, okay. And it was the first time where I was like, I'm just going to pound questions. And it sort of came out to the, you know, the sort of the scissor type thing. I was trying to neutralize my back leg. I was trying to be able to get some type of block into my front hip. You know, I was in the term almost being too athletic. My hips were rotating too fast. So it was finding a way to do that. You know, you see guys do it. You see the Altuves, you see Trout, and it's becoming more, you know, talked about. And so I went down there and he had a set of drills up. And I remember doing front toss literally on, we did T-work. They had a T-work in the cage, went to the field, went back to the cage. He was like, do you want to, he's like, do you want to like not play today? I'm like, no, like I'm not staying here for long. Like I refuse to like, it'd be like a month thing. So I played that game and after I DH, after every at bat, we would go back up there and we just pound in these drills. But I remember the first time I went and did front toss, he was like, hit a line drive, like over the second base. I mean, I absolutely pounded a ball and I was like, okay, like that would be something. So I ended up doing, I think I was in maybe 10 days and, I'll never forget this. Once I got called back up, I had a conversation with Danny Valencia. And I don't know if you remember that stretch. Danny was really struggling too. And he ended up going through a stretch. I think he got 12 consecutive hits and 12 at-bats. And he pulled me aside. He said, look, he goes, if I could do it, he's like, you can do it. Take one at-bat at a time. You know, and it was the first time I took the foot off the gas and just challenged myself to have one pitch at a time, one at bat at a time, be stubborn in my approach. And I mean, it clicked. I mean, arguably 2017 was the best year of my career. If you look at average home runs, you know, and I got away from it a little bit in 18. Literally the day before spring, I blow my oblique out and I had a great spring and I just couldn't get back to it. And then I really didn't get back to it until, you know, probably off season of going into 2020. So it was, it was a crazy ride, but I mean, I remember those days like yesterday, and those are the guys you appreciate those conversations, you know, 7-8 years later, and the time and the effort that either veterans are talking to you about or coaching, is helping you with, like, those are the ones you remember because you know, the onpouring of support guys are trying to do.
2017. He's the second best catcher of baseball. It's no offense, but Buster Posey was a little bit better. I don't know if you're familiar with his work, but he was all right. But like, yeah, like you were raking. Like this was about as good as like a catcher was that season, you know? And I think it must be cool for you to look back and be like, if X hadn't gone this way, if I had this consistent approach, if these injuries, like you did it. You fulfilled the expectations. You performed at the level that you expected from yourself within the confines of one season.
Yeah, and I think the biggest reward of that, I think I was hitting like 160 something with like 100 at bats. I think I ended up over 250. And I remember, I think it was the second to last game of the season was the first time I got over the 250 mark. And then I got over there and Scott, after that, like he took me out of the game. And he was like, hey, you're not playing tomorrow either. I think going back to that hotel room, it was in Anaheim. I remember it clear as day. I sat there and I took the biggest sigh of relief and I was like, what just happened? Like it was just a stretch that, you know, going into March and April, like it was, or excuse me, April and into May, like it seemed unfathomable. But and I tell guys that now, you know, it's like we put so much weight on a stretch of at-bats, but like once you've done something like that, you know, it may not be repeated, but you understand it's possible. And, you know, that little bit of knowledge and hope in the long term of a season is what really can get guys through.
It's clear that you have such a strong, you know, vivid recollection of so many of these individual small moments, so that we could go out, we could be pulling out random games from 2018 that I'm sure you could recall. But I do want to move a little bit more forward towards, again, you mentioned more injuries kind of make that next season a little bit more challenging. And then the trade happens. And I'm curious with Tampa Bay, like that was a big, a massive deal for you, I imagine, personally, of course, getting to go back closer to home. But from an organizational standpoint, it sounds like you really then had, not a second wind is a bad way to put it, but like the All-Star season comes in 21, right? 2020, you hit four homers in the postseason. I mean, the 2020 postseason is probably its own podcast on its own, I imagine. So, but I am curious for your tenure in Tampa Bay, what are the things that really stand out about how you kind of found another gear there, you know, being an All-Star? And there's some crazy stats about some of the power numbers you put up in 2021.
Yeah, so I mean, 2019, you know, I'm catching. I ended up getting hurt. I think we had three guys, maybe four catchers get hurt in Tampa. And we trade for Darnell, And like Trav's the man. He comes over, got DFA'd or let go by the Mets, goes over to the Dodgers. Then we trade for him because we needed somebody, and he went off. You know, so it's to a point, even when I came back, you know, he had taken the reins. And it was something where, you know, it was for the first time in my career where I was just like, man, like we're with a team, like let's win. Like, and I put the personal stuff and, you know, I always just wanted to win, but it was always so harped upon. Like, I felt like there was always a little bit more that I wanted to prove, you know, with the home crowd in Seattle, that the team that drafted me and invested so much in me. Then I got to Tampa and I've had conversations with these guys and expressed the value that they see in me. And I was like, well, let's just continue to bring that value. And, you know, I started making some changes towards the end of that season. And then 2020 comes, or the offseason going into 2020, and Eric Neander calls me, and we reach a deal, and he's like, but I'd like you to come in and, you know, meet with some of our, you know, biomechanists and all this stuff, and let's sort of get some evals on everything. So I went down there, did some stuff, sort of found where my body was, you know, where, like, how can I ship my quads off from catching and, you know, really get into my glutes and be stable and do a bunch of stuff like that. And I did that. I went this spring. And again, 2020 had a great spring, and then COVID happened. And I was like, damn. So I'm at home, you know, I got a net, I got a machine spitting foam balls at me as fast as they can. I'm trying to hang on to these swing changes I made, you know, like the guy I was working out with that all this information of what I was doing, like, couldn't really go see him, didn't know when we were coming back. So I was just trying to keep that in stock, like everything, you know, in a good motion. We come back, you know, took me almost until the playoffs back to where I was. And I think that was just the continued, you know, repetition and everything. And then, you know, it's funny how you come in and stretch a good playoffs and, you know, still get, you know, end up having I had an option on the end of the 2020 contract, got that declined because of the financial issues of COVID, and then reached another small deal with that big escalator contract and option for Tampa. But that 2020 playoffs really propelled me into a really good offseason and a really good mental state to go into 2021.
All right. So 2021, this is a great, unbelievable, historic season, because you hit 33 homers in 375 plate appearances, which is the third, basically it's like the fewest plate appearances to get to 30 homers. It's the third fewest in MLB history. Okay. So it's McGuire, Mitch Garver in 2019, and then you in 2021, 33 homers, 375 plate appearances. So when you're like, what is that experience like? Because when we talk to catchers or players who don't play every day, the overwhelming sense that I get is it's really difficult to stay in rhythm when you're only getting a certain amount of plate appearances a week. Whereas you somehow kept the rhythm going through 375 plate appearances.
Well, I mean, I remember that completely because, I mean, my years in Seattle, you know, I was catching in the 120s. I think I had almost close to the 130s. So, like, the volume was there. But then, like, Tampa, you know, I mean, Cashy and those guys are amazing. They know when to give you a break. That, you know, and it kept me fresh, but it got to a point when I was feeling really good and I was getting frustrated because I was like, man, like, just keep throwing me out. Like, I can do it. Like, just keep throwing me out there.
Yeah.
Then I think I was talking to my agent one time. He's like, have you ever seen your numbers like after you have an off day? And I'm like, no. And it was like, I was hitting like 500 with X amount of my homers, like after I had been given a day off. So then I was like, I wasn't looking for days off, but I was like, all right, like my mindset changed. I got my body taken care of. I got, you know, what I needed to done in the cage. And then I would go in there and I had this confidence of where it used to, like, if I had something going good and I had an off day, it was like, damn, like, how am I going to hold on to this? And then my mental, like, state shifted to like, all right, sweet. Like, I know what I need to do to, you know, get ready for this next day and then go catch three more in a row or catch four in a row. And I give credit to those guys. I mean, they lay out your playing schedule in advance. So, you know, like, you are fully prepared of what you're going to go do that week. And, you know, as a player, that's all you can ask for.
Let's stick on the homers here for a second. You hit a lot of them, not just 2021. What home runs stand out when you're thinking? I mean, it seems like you probably remember 90% of them based on your recall that you're describing. But, you know, you had a couple walk-offs in there. You, of course, had some postseason ones. You had some of the farthest home runs that we've seen in Major League Baseball over the last 10 years. Well, are there any individual ones that stand out to you that you look back on or go back and watch the highlights of because they're especially memorable?
I mean, I could, you know, like you said, I could rattle off a bunch. I think you don't really think about it until done or somebody asks you this question, but it's one of those things where going back to like my first career home run, like I remember like not sure if I believe it was Coco Crisp robbed it or not.
I had no idea. Yep, I remember. Yep.
You know, obviously the walk-off home runs, you know, the one I hit against, I believe it was Kinsler.
Yep, Kinsler. They were both against Minnesota, weirdly.
Yeah. The one to right center was one of those where like, I went up there with an approach. I knew he backdoored the two seam. I was trying to just stay inside of something and drive it that way. And it worked out. You know, the one against the grand slam against Cobb, I think that gave me like 8 or 9 RBI, something like that, that game. That was probably the farthest one I fit in Safeco. And then going to Tampa, the biggest one was obviously the couple I hit against McCullers. Just the one I hit in game 7 was just the same scenario. I mean, he was peppering me in a spot and he was throwing his breaking ball and it was sharp and I was just shifting my sights up and I found a couple heaters up in the zone that were like mid-90s and I just finally got, you know, a hanging breaking ball right where I was looking. It was like just getting and competing to get to that, I believe it was a 3-2 count or 2-2 count and putting that swing on it. And that scenario was just, you know, game 7 was a little weight lifted off the shoulders. I was like, all right, let's just go out and win this game because, you know, in those scenarios, you never know what's going to happen. It was, you know, my first taste of the playoffs. I didn't play in the playoffs in 19. And, you know, it was just cool to hit and do things like that in such big games.
You are now retired. You now get to hang out with your family and your kids. But you did mention there, you know, something also I'm always interested in with guys who retire is like, are you just going to never watch baseball? But from our conversation, that does not seem to be the case. So what is next? I know it's early. You just announced this. I don't know if you have, you know, imminent plans to get right back into the game. But what do you think this first year is going to look like in terms of Mike Zunino, the baseball fan?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, one of those things I'm excited to, I mean, the game's still as exciting as it ever has been to me. You know, the talent in the league, what's going on. Like I'm excited to watch it and be able to follow more. I mean, I think sometimes you get so blinded by either who you're playing or what's going on your team. You miss some of the other things going on in the sport. But yeah, for me, you know, I'm going to enjoy this time with family, continue to, you know, get to a spot where my body feels great and, you know, recovering from that career. But you know, like we don't live far outside the, you know, the city of Gainesville. So, you know, I go in and, you know, talk to the guys there at UF some, you know, and I don't know what could arise at the, you know, with the ranks of the major leagues. You know, I have intrigue with a lot of stuff. You know, I've the catching and pitching side of it, is huge for me. You know, I could go in and tell guys pretty much not to do it at the plate a lot of the times, but, you know, it's one of those things where I've introduced it just to listen to a bunch of stuff. You know, you see guys go in and, you know, maybe become special assistants or do stuff and just sort of learn more of the ins and outs and see which way they may prefer to go. But it's something that, you know, has been a keen interest to me. And I'll just take it as it comes. And in that time, just, you know, enjoy being a fan.
Well, it seems like you are you're in a pretty good spot, pretty healthy position. Very much looking forward to seeing what is next for Mike Zunino. We are very excited for you and very grateful that you gave us all this time. I know that we have been indirectly associated with your career,
Jordan,
for the goofiest of reasons.
Let me just ask,
I know our dear friend.
I want to ask quickly before we let Mike go. I want to ask you, Jordan, when you started tweeting Mike Zunino is good.
I need this backstory too. I don't want to ask as the interviewee.
I got you.
It's only fair. We've asked you enough questions.
Like, Jordan, there are many baseball players, some of whom, no offense, Mike, were better than Mike. Okay. What was it about Mike?
I never tweeted Buster Posey was good.
That's the thing. I guess everyone kind of knew that. Like, I guess my question for you, Jordan, is what about Mike within the context of the Mariners at that time and his game made you want to start tweeting out Mike Zunino is good every single time he hit a homer?
Yes. So I would say that, again, like the timing of all of it was very important. And I think, again, Mike, to give you background just on me personally in the 10-second version, like I really became a Mariners fan because of Felix Hernandez. This was not something, I had no Pacific Northwest ties. So it was really Felix was my favorite pitcher. And he really got me to start watching the Mariners all the time. And that really began like watching every day in 2013, right? So like as you're getting drafted and coming up and like watching your career and watching it, the ups and downs of it, once it started to all come together, and especially when we were all learning about the things you referenced, catcher framing, catcher defense, understanding what it means to be a catcher and the value that the catchers provide beyond the batting average, it was kind of it became a reason to be like, no, like, this guy is good. I don't care that he's hitting 200. Like, it was really that simple. And I think it was something that a lot of people, baseball fans and people who are more sabermetrically inclined, started to realize, like, to what it means to be a good catcher is so much more than one stat or anything. And then obviously once you're hitting 250 with slugging 600, then it's a lot easier to do it anyway. But it was really that whole thing and the appreciation of the catcher position, the fact of everything that you kind of gone through at the beginning of your career with the injuries, with the being sent down, really in that narrative of being sent down and called back up and it all coming together, I was like, it's happening. And we all have to accept it. He is good. I know we've been waiting for it, but it is happening. And so that's really the gist of it. And obviously, I'm very fortunate that you indirectly not being on social media, bless your heart, has been a good sport about it, because I understand that at some point, I imagine your lovely wife let you know about this. But I don't know. I'm curious when you started to find out too, honestly.
I mean, the first time I heard it, I think it was like PR guys at the Mariners, like, have you heard about this? And I was like, I've been off since like 2012. I got no idea. But they started saying it. And then you started like some people around like the stands and stuff like that were like, whether it was like shirts or whatever. And I was like, what the hell is going on? And, but no, it's one of those things, like all the things you said, you know, it's one of those full circle things. You know, for me, if, you know, there wasn't those struggles in some of those times, you know, I don't think I dive as deep, you know, into maybe the catching position, the defensive side of it, you know, the game calling, the importance of pitcher-catcher relationships. You know, there's so much that gets touted on the offensive numbers. I think that sometimes the hardest thing to young catchers and to implement with them is how do you learn your guys? What do they do well? And how can you navigate them through a game? You know, and, you know, I wanted to do that. You know, it's not easy when you're a 22-year-old kid, and you know, it's Felix and Joe Saunders and Hisashi Iwakuma, and you're just sitting there and you're like, man, these guys are established veterans, you know, but if I show them that I am willing to put them first, and how can I do that? So like I said, during that time, you know, funny, I didn't know much about it. I always wanted the backstory as we ran into each other in spring training fields and stuff like that. But like I said, going back to that part of it, you know, any of that, because I think what I've learned through those years and what I can help people with now in that part of the game was solely correlated with, you know, some of the struggles, but it also let me dive deeper into certain aspects of the game.
Well,
oh man, Mike Zunino, good player, good person, good podcast guest. I have 100 more questions, but you have your retirement to go enjoy. So thank you so much for your time. Enjoy retirement. Best to your family. Thank you for everything that you've done for us as goofy baseball fans and baseball internet creators. Congratulations on an incredible career, Mike. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate you having me.
Enjoy doing nothing. And welcome back to the end of this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, no longer Mike Zunino. Maybe he'll come back at some point during the season and update us on his retirement. We're very appreciative that Mike Z made the time, and just kind of a cool pinch yourself fun thing.
Like, yes.
Our jobs are stupid and weird, and we grow up and become slightly more professional over time. But whenever we get the opportunity to do something like that with someone who has meant something to yes. us is cool.
Yes. So even if you were like, what the hell are they talking about? Who's Mike Zunino? Why does anyone care about him? Hopefully you enjoyed that conversation. Now, we said to Mike, oh, what are you going to do in retirement? Well, there's a lot of options. He could do anything, right? We said, oh, is Mike Z going to stick around baseball? Well, one option for Mike Zunino is to join our Baseball Barbacast Fantasy League. I don't know if he's going to. We'll see. We'll have to follow up with him. But if you want to join the first ever Baseball Barbacast Fantasy League, email us. Let us know why you should be in the league. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. It will, of course, be on Yahoo Sports. You can sign up for fantasy baseball right now at Yahoo, yahoo.com/fantasybaseball, or on the Yahoo Fantasy app. We are going to, I think, probably Monday. So Jake and I are actually going to be in the same place on Monday. I'm going to be in New York. So we're going to be recording some pods in person. But on Monday, we will announce when the draft will be. We have received some incredible submissions. Again, people being like, yeah, I'm around 24/7. You want to draft at 3 a.m.? Sounds good. Oh, this is why I should be in the league. Like, it's so funny. You people are incredible.
Let us know. Yeah. Keep letting us know why you should be in the league. Maybe, Jordan, we do a pod or some content around our favorite responses and pick the people who will be in the league.
Right.
I am very excited.
Let me just say this. It's very much making me want to do a 12-team at least instead of a 10-team, because I want to make sure we get as many of these people as possible. So thank you all for listening.
Can we do like three catchers?
Oh my God. I think a four catcher AL only league. Who says no? Everybody. Thank you all for listening. BaseballBarbercast@gmail.com. Thank you to Mike Tonino. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Brett Rader for making this episode possible. And we'll be back tomorrow on Friday with our American League West preview. But until then, enjoy. Thank you all. Padres fans, you have Dylan Cease. White Sox fans, you're going to be really bad. All right, bye.
White Sox fans, you have Jerry Reinsdorf.